The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com. Metaxas Show with your host, Eric Metaxas.
Folks, Metaxas Show. I'm Eric Metaxas, and I'm in Tampa. I don't know how this happened. I don't even have time to look into it. I'm just here, and I'm doing my show. And the beauty of being, I'm at a Turning Point USA convention, is you get to bump into people that normally you wouldn't bump into. For example, today, right now, I'm going to speak with James Lindsay. Who's James Lindsay, you say? I don't have an easy answer for you. All I can tell you is that, well, two things. He has a new book called Cynical Theories, How Activist Scholarship Made Everything About Race, Gender, and Identity, and Why This Harms Everybody. He's co-written the book with Helen Pluckrose. First, James, let me at least say welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
You came to my attention. I want my audience to get this, because this is so delicious, so wonderful, that I said to earlier, my head exploded, to use the cliche du jour. I heard that some academics who were sane people, maybe conservatives, I don't know, had decided to scam the world of... What do you even call that world? You know, critical theory, the academic nut house, the academic booby hatch, where everything is about, you know, the patriarchy and Marxism and feminism, and just the looniness of that world, that you and some others had written papers and submitted them to academic journals, and that you were, I mean, this was obviously stuff that you made up for the fun of it. And you submitted them, and they were accepted and published. When I heard that, I just could not believe how wonderful this was. And I said, someday I got to meet this guy. So I'm thrilled to meet you today. Tell my audience the provenance of that exercise and, you know, where you were at that point in life.
Sure. I mean, it's a little bit of a complicated story. I don't want to bog it down too much. What that's called, usually, by the way, is the theoretical humanities. Which is a terrible, it's like a totalitarian phrase, I think.
Well, of course it is. It's made up. The theoretical humanities. It's not reality-based. It's theoretical and ideological. It's crazy. But it exists in academia. And so you decided to play the game, make fun of it.
Yeah, exactly. And it's very much, it's a little bit ironic because, you know, we were looking for a metaphor a moment ago, and it's more like a cuckoo than it is, because it lays the egg in the nest and it displaces real scholarship with this bogus Marxist critical analysis of everything, as Marx said, ruthless criticism of everything that exists. So what turns out is we were actually, the three of us, we're all atheists. We were involved.
Now, who are these three?
So Helen Pluckrose did it with me and another fellow named Peter Boghossian. The three of us wrote these fake papers together.
And where were you physically?
I was in Knoxville, and Peter is in Portland, Oregon, and Helen is in London.
Okay, and so the three of you knew each other somehow?
Twitter.
Okay, so you discovered each other through Twitter.
Yeah.
And your academics, what academic field were you in Knoxville at that time?
Mathematics.
Oh, I forgot. You're a mathematician.
Yeah, I'm a mathematician. Peter is a philosopher. And Helen is a, she has a master's in literature. Late medieval, early modern literature.
Wow. Late medieval, early modern. I didn't know that was a category. I thought I don't think medievalism goes far enough to bump into early modernism. You mean early modern? That's a different term, I guess.
That's an argument for her. I have no idea. I just repeat what
I think
hear.
What you really mean is Edmund Spencer.
Yeah, probably.
Okay, so let's break this down. You were an atheist. Was uh-huh. Helen an atheist?
Yes, all three.
And Boghossian was an atheist.
Yeah.
So you're atheist, but you still have a fidelity to what we might call reality and sanity
reality,
and
objective truth
and logic.
Exactly.
And so you're observing that the academy has gone insane, especially in the humanities.
Right.
And you thought, let's have some fun.
Right. And the relevance of atheism is that it hit there first. They went crazy 10 years before everybody else. As it's progressive, it's left, of course. And so it melted down. And we were getting, you know, everybody we knew was getting accused of systemic sexism or systemic race, all this jargon and terminology. So we started reading the literature to find out what it was. And we thought, what in the world is this? And finally, one day, we saw this paper that got published in 2016 that was, a feminist glaciology paper. And it's like, what?
Wait.
Yeah.
We're talking about glaciers?
Glaciers.
That is ice.
Ice.
And somehow, this article about glaciers somehow meant to take this from a feminist perspective. Now, is that even tenuously possible?
No, not in reality.
Thank you.
No.
I was looking for a simple yes or no answer.
No, the answer
is no. It's insanity.
It's more insane than you think. I mean, they literally have a part in the paper where they advocate a feminist geography and glaciology would include the feminist woman who paints pictures of glaciers should be included within the science because that's pictures of glaciers too.
Okay.
I'm watching your mouth hang open.
We need to pause for station identification. Seriously, I mean, it's hard for me. I want my audience, to understand how crazy this is. So we have to kind of take it slow because we're saying things. Most people who live their lives, they don't have the freedom to live in a world of lunacy. They have to, they've got to put food on the table. They work their jobs. If you're late, that's a problem. Like, there are these fixed things. There's time. There's money. There's the material world. And yet, in the academy, people are free, really, to drift with the clouds. They're completely unmoored from anything, to the point where there are people crazy enough to write about something called feminist geology or geography.
Yeah.
I mean, you're sitting here and we laugh, but you're telling me, no, this is a real paper.
This paper was
published in 2016.
Got a lot of National Science Foundation money.
You mean taxpayer money?
I mean, they were on a much larger grant. This paper came out of a much bigger project, but that project was funded to $800,000 of taxpayer money.
Okay, folks, do you understand why I need to pay attention? Taxpayer money. That's your money and my money. We made that money, and it's being used for this stuff. And people are making those decisions. So basically, that whole world, the academy, has been taken over by nuts. I mean, I say nuts because I don't have the time to think of a better term. They're basically crazy, and they are in an echo chamber of people who, if not crazy, are at least unwilling to speak against the craziness, unwilling to impose any logic, give any pushback. So your initial reaction is, let's have some fun.
No, my initial reaction when I saw that paper was a part of me died. That this exists at all. I mean it. For 3 days, I just kind of locked myself in a room, not all the way locked in, but like I wouldn't interact. I stayed in the dark. I was just depressed to see this assault on science. And then it was, these people are ripe for a hoax like Alan Sokol did in 1995 to expose postmodern nonsense with his so-called fashionable nonsense book that he wrote.
I don't remember that. What was that?
Yeah, so Alan Sokol was watching the same thing happening. It was creeping into science in the 90s. There were people like Luce Irigaray, French postmodern feminist, writing things like E equals MC squared is a sexed equation because it privileges the speed of light above all other speeds. That's an exact quotation, by the way.
Say that again.
E equals MC squared is a sexed equation.
A sexed? You mean sexist, basically?
Yes. Made sexist.
E equals MC squared. Is 1 plus 1 equals 2 also somehow sexist or racist?
Yes.
You know what? I apologize. Math is inherently systemically racist.
That's right.
And that's why I never did very well in math. I was always a humanities guy.
Yeah,
so
it'll get you.
But, I mean, I keep having to interrupt because I know my audience is probably thinking, so this is real? They're not making this up? We're not making this up. You, James Lindsay, my guest, you lived in this world. So when this stuff was coming out, it must have disturbed you. But this goes back at least to 1995. So what did Sokol do initially?
He wrote a paper saying that gravity is a social construct and just ripped quotes out of their postmodern,
literature. So he did what you guys did.
Yeah, but with physics. And they published it in a journal called Social Text out of Duke University. And big scandal. front page of the New York Times. He ends up getting a major book deal out of it. You know, he's a physicist and a mathematician. Lots of impact. It actually did a big bit of damage in the 90s to what was...
So he gamed the system and won because, just like you guys, his stuff was published and it blew up.
Yeah, exactly. And so we said, well, they fell for it once. We can do it again. So let's try it. And we just took off, and that's when the fun began.
My guest is James Lindsay. The book is Cynical Theories, How Activist Scholarship Made Everything About Race, Gender, and Identity, and Why This Harms Everybody. We'll be right back.
Hey there, folks. How many years have I been telling you about Relief Factor? What, like four? The truth is, I know there are millions of people, in fact, some say over 100 million people struggling with some kind of pain, maybe from exercise, just getting older. That could do it, getting older, which is why I am so impressed with Pete and Seth Talbot. They are on a mission. You rarely see this kind of focus and commitment. Seriously, they recently shared with me that they are doubling down and want to literally double their total number of happy customers in the next year. And I believe they'll do it. So here's the deal. If you're struggling with back, neck, shoulder, hip, or knee pain, even general muscle aches and pains, then I'm suggesting you order their 3-week quick start, still discounted to only $19.95, about a dollar a day, to see if we can get you out of pain too. And then after that, less than the cost of a cup of coffee a day to stay out of pain. Go to relieffactor.com, relieffactor.com, or call 800-500-8384, relieffactor.com, 800-500-8384. I use it. It works. Check it out.
Folks, I'm talking to James Lindsay, who, together with Helen Pluckrose, has written a book called Cynical Theories, How Activist Scholarship Made Everything About Race, Gender, and Identity, and Why This Harms Everybody. I mean, look, there's no doubt that the Academy has always been at the cutting edge of lunacy, right? I mean, I don't know who it was who said some ideas are so preposterous that it takes an intellectual to believe them, but if you're in an academic environment, you're unmoored from the realities of the marketplace. You can get away with crazy stuff. You're not going to be called on the carpet because there's just that accountability doesn't exist by definition. At least
right. It
has existed less and less. But it's kind of come to a tipping point in a way. I mean, how can the entire Academy have been taken over by these people? And isn't it a snake swallowing its own tail at some point?
I think it's been one actually all along, but it's getting pretty far down from the tail into the body, getting close to its own head, I think, at this point. But the way that it got taken over was people who should have known better didn't. People who should have said no didn't. You know, this in the 60s this was starting, and people should have said, this isn't scholarship. This is sophistry. We know what sophistry is. It goes back to the Greeks. We're well-versed in this. In the humanities, they should know this. They know the classics. We know sophistry. This is not philosophy. It's out. And they didn't do it.
Harold Bloom pushed back against this at Yale. When I was there, Jacques Derrida and, you know, the supposed Gang of Four, this was all the fashion. And you're right. It's gone on and on and on. And now we're at this point where it's infected the mainstream, that these crazy ideas are coming out into middle America. And I think your average American is finally waking up because they're saying, wait a minute, what? You're teaching my child what?
Yeah.
This is the dumbest thing I've ever heard. This is not even something we need to have a conversation about. This is idiotic.
Yeah. And it was very, very kind of tricky in that regard, right? It snuck in under the radar. And people had this myth that they believed. They believed, oh, well, you know, once these kids, whatever, in the university, once these kids get to the real world will straighten them out. But no, what happened is they got into the real world and there were so many of them, so many college graduates.
It took decades. Look, we have to go back. Buckley, in the early 50s, wrote God and Man at Yale. He's writing about the Yale of the 40s, ladies and gentlemen. Already, communism and atheism had taken over the faculty of Yale University. So when you think of a place like Yale, you think, oh, it's an elite institution. My kids are going to go there. They're going to learn this great stuff. Already in the 40s, this stuff had taken over. So you're right. It's been under the radar because your average parent doesn't understand who are these people teaching my kids.
Right.
They just think, oh, we got a Yale sweatshirt and a Yale degree, and he's going to get a job. But this has been underground for a long time. I mean, this goes back even before that. So, but finally, it's come out.
That's right.
And because it's come out, it strikes me that we can deal with it.
That's right. Yeah, this is It's like it's finally showed itself, so we can finally start to do something about it. And as you said, everybody who sees it looks at it and they say, this is insanity. And the hard part is that it's all, you know, elaborate rhetoric, and so it's not theory, it's all rhetorical nonsense. But they have a lot of linguistic savvy, and they can make good-sounding arguments. I don't want to say good arguments. Good-sounding arguments that keep people trapped into not being able to fight back against it competently. But once people get just a little bit of their feet underneath them, because that's what it does, it starts to sweep your feet out from under you. Once you get your feet underneath you just a little bit, you know, common sense starts to come back.
Well, I just want to say, you said at the beginning of this, in 2016, you were an atheist. You're no longer an atheist.
I still am, but my religious friends call me an agnostic.
Well, I have written a book coming out in October called Is Atheism Dead? And my conclusion in writing that book is it's not intellectually possible to be an atheist. It's possible to be an agnostic. But atheism really is just no longer tenable. We can discuss that another time. But so what is the ground of all being for you? In other words, if you're talking about reality, what is reality for you? What is truth for you? How is that not all a social construct if there's no such thing as God?
Well, I mean, I don't think that we disagree much except in what we call what we see. If that answers your question.
No, say that again.
I don't think we disagree except in what we call what we see.
Right.
So for me, reality is a brute fact. We have, as a part of reality, the faculties to make sense of reality and understand reality. And there's an objective truth about that reality and about human nature as such, as a part of that reality. And so we can learn that. Everything is not socially constructed. Everything is not a fiction. Everything is not a speculative philosophy that's detached from that reality. Mm. I just don't follow Aquinas's final step and say, this all men call God.
Well, I don't follow Aquinas at all. So we're in the same place right there. So in the book that you've co-written with Helen Pluckrose, Cynical Theories, what do you talk about? Because I know that there are people that will be interested in this.
So this is a huge, of course, subject. Like you said, it's a very long project within the humanities and within the universities. We talk about the influence of a philosophy called postmodernism. You mentioned Jacques Derrida. On the development of this craziness that we experience, this complete detachment from reality that we experience in the world, the reframing of claims about objective truth as social constructions that carry political power with them. And we, of course, reject that claim. We believe in reality. We are realists. We believe that we can understand reality. We do not believe that every claim about reality is just an expression of power that was socially constructed so that the people who made it can maintain their grip on power and resources and opportunity and money. We reject that claim. So we're tracing that history that led to critical race theory, right, gender theory, queer theory, post-colonial theory, fat studies, disability studies, and so on and so forth.
Fat studies?
Oh, yeah.
Fat studies? Did you say fat studies?
Yeah, one of our fake papers was about that.
Fat studies?
Yeah, we said that if the sport of professional bodybuilding didn't include a category called fat bodybuilding, that it was being unfairly exclusionary toward fat bodies because there's no real difference between building muscle and building fat.
You know what? You're right. I'm starting to feel better about myself. That's so funny. Fat studies. I can't get over that. I mean, on this program, I think it's often just my job to stop the conversation and to say to my audience, can you believe this? We're talking about fat studies. Queer theory is equally preposterous, but it's probably people can get their heads around that level of lunacy. But when you're talking about fat studies,
It's really dangerous.
I don't know where to go.
It's hard not to laugh at it, honestly. It's impossible to criticize without sounding like you're making fun of it.
I am making fun of it.
We should. However, it's actually very dangerous because kind of the core belief of fat studies at the center is that the claim that obesity is a medical problem with medical consequences is just a application of power by doctors who prefer thinness over fatness for arbitrary reasons.
Except for fat doctors.
And so, you know, that's very dangerous, though. There are a raft of health-related problems, disasters in the making. Obesity crisis epidemic is real, and it's causing many health problems for people. And to deny that and just say that it's an application of power to make people who are over... You're not allowed to say overweight because that presumes that there's a correct weight.
Can I say chunky?
You can.
What about husky?
Thick is the word of the day.
It's thick. I know. I was with somebody who used the word thick. I was like, what's that? Thick.
It ends in two C's, not a K.
A little meat on the bone, folks. That's what we're talking about. Okay, so you deconstruct, to use this word now, the deconstructors.
That's
right?
Correct, yeah.
And you I guess I just want to say that, you know, when you're talking about this kind of thing, it always comes down to power. It seems to me to be deeply, corrosively cynical at its base, but also to be rather clearly culturally Marxist. I mean, if we're talking about power, it is by definition to me cultural Marxism. Isn't that where all this stuff came from?
Yes. Again, a simple one-word answer will do. This is a evolution, or if you actually understand the theory, it is a dialectical progression of cultural Marxism into a new frame where it can be applied, say, in the American context.
Okay, so for people who are just tuning in, tell my audience, what is, according to you, what is cultural Marxism?
Cultural Marxism is the application of Marx's view of a stratification, a split in society between, say, the bourgeoisie and the proletariat, the upper class and the lower class. So there's a stratification, an upper and a lower, and they are fundamentally in conflict with one another, such that the upper class maintains an illusory consciousness in the lower class to exploit them. And then the goal in Marxism is to awaken that consciousness of their exploitation so that they will revolt and create a collectivist proletariat dictatorship that's now going to usher us toward, you know, a better future, a communist perfect utopia. And so that's Marxism. He did it with economics. Now you switch this to, you switch this out of saying, oh, it's about means of production. You say it's, oh, it's about means of producing art and media and literature and education and the family.
And the reason the switch was made, let's be honest, is because actual communism, the economic kind, that kind of Marxism, had been shown, demonstrated to be an utter failure. Because of that, they had to say, we didn't really mean that. Here's what we mean. And they change things quickly, right? So you catch somebody in a lie, and he changes, gives you a new lie. So the idea that Gramsci and others said, we're going to take this concept of pitting people against other people, of dividing people, you call it stratification, and it's no longer going to be the bourgeoisie and the proletariat. Now it's going to be any of these other categories, but the principle is the same. We're going to pit people against other people. We're going to tell them who their enemies are, and we're going to get leverage by doing that.
That's exactly right. And so early on, it was high culture versus low culture. Then in the 60s, it switched to associating identity factors with culture, race, gender, etc.
We're going to be right back, folks. I'm talking to James Lindsay, the book is Cynical Theories.
It makes a lot to say.
Folks, I'm talking to James Lindsay, co-author with Helen Pluckrose of Cynical Theories. We were talking about cultural Marxism, and again, I want my audience to understand this because I've only really understood this fairly recently, where you really understand where this is all coming from. And I would say to you, you're an agnostic, I'm a Christian, but I would say that what I find interesting ideologically as I, you know, try to parse this, make sense of it, where does it fit in the world? When you're talking about cultural Marxism and this division of people, pitting people against other people, making this group the scapegoat, whether it's the Jews or the rich people or the clerical, ecclesiastical establishment, we're going to demonize someone and we're going to leverage people's animus, kind of natural animus, against that group. But I don't know what was in Marx's head, but it is a very, very cynical, amazingly cynical way of seeing the world.
Oh, yeah. It's very, very dark. And in fact, by the time you get to the cultural Marxists and the neo-Marxists, it's blatantly a conspiracy theory. But you have these people who produce the culture, and they do so with the cynical motive that, you know, they can, of course, read those minds. And the cynical motive to keep everybody else down, to keep everybody oppressed so that they can maintain, you know, the small cabal of people can maintain their power over the world. So it's extremely cynical. That's why we called the book Cynical Theories, not least, especially, because they believe that they can read their opponents' minds and that their motivations must always be the worst possible motivation that you could land upon so that they can continue to stoke that grievance, to stoke that resentment, that ressentiment, as it really is.
Ressentiment. You want to say that, we want to use the same word Derrida would have used. Isn't he dead?
He is dead, yeah.
He's dead. But he's not always been dead.
No, he was alive for a while.
I met him when I was at Yale. I guess it was 82 or 83. He came and he visited. And I once escorted him across the Calhoun College, residential college, been renamed Popper or Hopper or something. But I escorted him under an umbrella. It was a light drizzle. and there was a wiffle ball game going on, and I had to kind of guide him through the outfield, you know, to safety. And that was my moment with Jacques Derrida, the zeitgeist in a French suit. It's so strange that these people were really kind of idolized in the academic world. He was somebody that, I mean, for my audience and for me, tell us who he was in that movement. Why did he become so popular?
I mean, he was ultimately, in some regard, and I use this in the loosest sense, a linguist. He was studying the idea of how reality is structured, I mean, quite literally, by the way we interpret language. So he comes out of this structuralist tradition that he wanted to, you know, take apart. And he said, well, we don't really, our words don't signify things. They signify ideas. And then those are really only describable in other words. So our words only point to other words. And so he was a person who was actually hollowing out our ability to get to meaning. One of his challenges, and I know it's a little philosophical to say this, is he said, he used to challenge his students, if anybody can bring me a signified, that which is signified by a word or an idea or language, somebody can bring me an actual signified, then I'll give them an A in whatever course or whatever it was, you know, a prize. And because he believed that words never point to reality at all.
Okay, so if I bring him a rock and I say, this is the rock, and the word rock signifies this thing, he would say what?
He would say, no, that's an example of a class of things called rocks. There are many different rocks. What is a rock? And so there are so many different things that could be called rocks. That's just one example of a classification of things that we refer to as rocks that itself is ambiguous. It can't be nailed down. It can't be made solid, to use a pun. You know, it can't be understood as such. And so what you really brought me is an example of a thing we understand in a word called rock that's not very clear what a rock actually is. And it's a single example, so you failed.
So if you said something like that, you know, at the dinner table in my house, you get smacked in the head, and you say, now go do your homework, I've had enough. And that's the logical response to that level of idiocy.
Yeah, I grew
up the
same way.
But in the academic world, you can just go on and on. It's Derrida and others, they took annoyance to a high academic level. Like, it's this sort of the annoying 13-year-old who just needs to get smacked in the head. It's like, get out of here. But they were allowed to make careers of this stuff. And it is just, it's just so fascinating to me that here we are dealing with it. There's something about the structure of the culture in which we live that allowed this lunacy. I mean, I would see it this way, is that in a real wartime or in times of difficulty, you don't have the ability to countenance this foolishness. But in the West and in post-war America particularly, we've been so blessed with so much freedom and relative wealth and leisure that we have allowed this nonsense to have some room to grow. Yeah. That's how I see it.
No, it's true. You have to be extraordinarily comfortable, whether as a professor or as a rich upper middle class or lower upper class Westerner, to be able to, you know, think that this is a good description of reality and that this stuff, you know, is the best way to understand the world that we live in. It's a completely luxury belief in that regard.
Now, you're a mathematician. So where did you grow up and where did you go to college and how did you become a mathematician to begin with?
I grew up in East Tennessee and I decided near the end of my time in high school I wanted to be a physicist. So I majored in physics for undergraduate and I got a degree in physics in 2001. And then I changed. I did not want to be a physicist anymore after I took classical electricity and magnetism, which is hard. And so I switched gears to the mathematics, which I'd always also been interested in. And I fell in love with it.
Downshifted to math.
Yeah,
that's
I think
kinda
so.
That's kind of
crazy. And I loved it. And so I did my PhD at the University of Tennessee. And
I've always wanted to meet somebody who loved math. And now that I've met you, I realize, no, I don't. No, it's just so funny to me. It's so funny to me how God creates us, at least I see it, so differently. The idea that, for me, you know, as soon as I hit pre-calculus, I realized, I'm not enjoying this the way I'm enjoying history and English. And how some people just flourish and they love it. We're over time. We'll be right back. I'm talking to James Lindsay. So when you decided you wanted to have an academic career, in mathematics. Where did you see that going?
This was pure math, abstract math. It's not real employable. But what I saw finishing my PhD was that the university had gone through a tremendous political administrative shift. It wasn't going woke, or maybe it was, but I didn't know it. It was switching to student retention, uber alles. And so the goal now was keep the students happy, keep the students paying. Don't fail anybody. Don't make them feel bad. Whatever they want. And when you start to realize that the lunatics are going to be running the asylum real quick, I thought, I can't teach honestly like this. I can't teach honestly with a quota where I'm not allowed to fail more than one student or something. In math, where often 70% of a class might fail.
This is, it's so extraordinary when things get the upper hand. When the bottom line, the money, the free market says that we're gonna prioritize this over this, truth goes out the window. Obviously, you cannot have standards if once that happens. But you're saying this happened at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville.
It happened at all the universities. There's a huge arms race after Clinton federally underwrote every single student loan, so all of a sudden they had an infinite pot of money to try to compete for, because no longer was there anything over anybody's head in terms of being able to go to college. They could just fund it. It was all federally underwritten.
Well, so it's interesting to me because you're talking about it's just an amazing thing that money comes into the picture, and all these universities who forgot why they were there to begin with just decide we're businesses and we're going to go after the money. But once you go after the money, truth is the casualty, or
that's
at
right.
least certainly in math, we're talking about, you know, truth and stuff. But I just, it's just so crazy because there are things we take for granted, that the way a university works or the way that, you know, and the idea that this stuff, while nobody's paying attention, happens, these ideas get in there. I just have to ask you, because I've heard this, I don't know who said it, maybe it was Einstein who first popularized the idea that it's fascinating that the universe can be described through math, that the laws of physics can be described via math. Because I'm not a mathematician, and I got a 1 on the AP physics exam because I didn't study for 5 minutes, I don't really understand why people are so fascinated by that. Can you explain why people are fascinated by this idea that there's this thing called math that can describe the way the physical universe works? Why is that amazing?
I don't know. You asked the wrong guy. I actually feel like you do. That I feel like, in fact, and this is very controversial in the philosophy of mathematics,
yeah.
I think that math is ultimately empirical. People were measuring things, and they came up with numbers to tick off the marks one after another, and it all came from looking at how numbers work, and the
right.
numbers turn into fractions. Fractions can then be extended logically into abstract concepts like real numbers and complex numbers and functions and so
right.
on. But I think it's all got its roots in very basic axioms that truly are self-evident. And then it's just logic applied to that, and logic is right. You know, you're a Christian, not to step on you, but John 1 says that's where that comes from. Logic is right.
What do you mean, John 1? That's where. What does John say in John 1 that...
Well, in the beginning, there was the Word, and the Word was God, was with God, and the Word was God. And so if you go back to Word, is Logos, and Logos is logic, then the logical structure of the world... I mean, I don't mean to get theological. It's
why not?
Not my game, but...
It's more fun than talking about phallocentric criticism.
Well, I don't know. I can get that pretty
fun.
Yeah,
I know.
But no, I think that logic works. Logic is what logic is because logic works. Logic is the way to take one idea from point A to point B, from point B to point C, and to understand what's going on. So when you have axioms in mathematics, like these are what numbers are, and this is how numbers work,
right.
and they actually are self-evident descriptions of reality,
right.
then what flows from that just by applying logic is going to be a very comprehensive description of reality. So I don't see the mystery. I've disagreed with most mathematicians on that.
It's kind of funny because I'm with you on that. I mean, obviously I'm a Christian, but I've never really understood why that's so astonishing. Look, we may be missing something, but I'm always open to new ideas, man.
I mean, a lot of mathematicians just think that math is squiggles on paper, and then they're like, wow, it works in reality. I think that may be it. But it's not. They don't think about where it comes from. There's a famous mathematician whose name is Ian something, and I can't think of his last name, that said that most mathematicians have they're philosophically an unexamined blend of Platonism and formalism, which means they don't think about why math is what math is. They
right.
just unexamined.
Well, that's not their
blend.
Job. Their job is to do math.
Right.
It's kind of like, you know, Richard Dawkins, you know, he does science. But then when he talks about science, he sounds like an idiot, at least from what I've read. I mean, it's embarrassing. You realize he's good at science. He's not good at philosophizing about science.
Well, they're different.
Or about the material world. But he feels, because we live in a world where, you know, the Enlightenment, the new priesthood of, you know, Enlightenment thinkers and scientists, they kind of, we act as though they're oracles, and so we ask them, you know, please tell me, what's the meaning of life, when their job is just to do science. And
well,
so,
yeah, exactly.
Have you read, I was really, because I did this, wrote this book called Is Atheism Dead, I for the first time forced myself to read some of the stuff by Dawkins or Hitchens, and I find it unpleasant because I find it very, I mean, just intellectually tremendously sloppy. And I was really disappointed. I said, I know there are better atheists than this, but they became so popular. Do you have any views on that? Because it's just, it was a strange phenomenon to me.
I mean, I could guess at it. The thing is that there were, the new atheism movement, in its essence, shares many things in common with critical theory. It's almost a critical theory of religion. And there are reasons why critical theory goes viral, especially in certain circumstances. It's got a hot take flavor to it. It's got that, you know, oh, you smashed the other person, you owned them, or, you know, destroyed in all caps,
you
or whatever.
You owned the libs.
Yeah, it's got that feeling to it. But it also taps into this feeling, I think, that a lot of people have, which is everything you've always known is wrong. Everything they've told you is wrong. And so there's a different level of cynicism there. Like, you know, it feels like being red-pilled. And I think that it catches on for people who, you know, feel like their religion was disconnecting from them, they were seeing abuse in the churches or whatever.
Right, but the problem is you can criticize all that and you can be absolutely right, but then what? Then what do you say, you know, where are we? Where does it leave us? And that's when it gets confusing. And that's what fascinated me, is I thought, but Hitchens and Dawkins, they just take pot shots at all the stuff they don't like, but their logical conclusions strike me as obviously preposterous. They don't really get anywhere. They just criticize, and they think that's enough. That's all I needed to do. We're going to go to break. Final segment with James Lindsay. The book is Cynical Theory. I'm talking to James Lindsay, the author of Cynical Theories, How Activist Scholarship Made Everything About Race, Gender, and Identity. And James, I was saying that, you know, we were talking about math, but you, you know, are that rare mathematician who can write about ideas. You don't just do math. You philosophize about math and ideas. When did that start for you? When did you leave, you know, pure math and say, I'm interested in writing about ideas?
Well, the interest started before I got into math. So I was that way as a teenager. I wanted to dig into the roots. I wanted to study all the world philosophies and religions and learn what people thought and how ideas developed. So that interest was already there. That foundation came with me into mathematics. And then, like I said, I left the university after watching this shift towards student retention. I didn't want to be a part of that. I left the university in 2010, and I still wanted to engage with ideas, though. So I still wanted to get involved and to discuss and to debate and to write and to think and to read. And so that started to shift. And without having it's very difficult without having an institutional culture around you to do a subject like math, which is really hard. You need other mathematicians thinking about math around you, saying math things around you, pointing you in the direction of
saying math things around you.
Yeah.
Avogadro's number? No, that's more of a physics
thing.
No,
more like, I think Chebyshev polynomials might apply to this problem in a way that you never thought about before.
Gesundheit.
Yeah, exactly.
So, what are you doing these days since you've left the academy officially? What are you doing?
I created a company called New Discourses. And New Discourses has a website called newdiscourses.com. And what I do is I study critical theory as far back and in as deep, as much depth as I can. And I try to explain to the world where it came from, what it is, how it thinks, including critical race theory most prominently right now and probably at the most depth. But these queer theory, the gender theory, the fat studies we laughed about earlier. Like, where did these things come from? I actually go read the primary sources, and then I understand them, and I report on them. That's what I do all day long, every day.
The fact that you read the primary sources, that's, you know, I just want to take my hat off to you, because I don't think I can get past the first paragraph without dying.
It's the abyss.
It is the abyss. So you're still in Tennessee?
I still am in Tennessee.
And if people want to find you online?
they can go to newdiscourses.com, or they can follow me on social media at Conceptual James.
Conceptual James. So it's... You publish a journal. What is the
New Discourses has articles, it has videos, and it has mostly right now a podcast. I do podcast episodes about as fast as I can put them out. A lot of what I do on it lately is read the primary sources while I interpret them for you, like Herbert Marcuse's Neo-Marxism from the 60s. I just read his essays, and then this is what he's saying. This is what it means. This is what the words mean. When he says democracy, this is why he means communism.
You know, it is really kind of funny. I would think that because you're doing this, that you would have some kind of a cult following in the academy, that there are grad students and professors and associate professors and assistant professors around the country who are thinking this stuff, but they don't have an outlet or they don't know where to go.
And I literally just met one before I came over to the table. Literally, one came up to me and was like, psst, you know, I'm a grad student. Thank you.
So they have to be out there, because not all grad students are insane or fake woke or whatever it is. They really are reality based, and they think, gosh, I've got to live in this world. So you're a voice of sanity and reason in the midst of that madness. So I would think that you would be increasingly popular over time, because there's just a lot of these folks out there. So when did you start New Discourses?
We started it in February of 2020.
Okay, so yeah, you guys are pretty new.
Yeah.
So I'm just thinking that, folks, if you know anybody in the so-called academy, in the university system, let them know about New Discourses and about James Lindsay. James, just a joy to get to meet you. Thank you for what you do, and thanks for your time.
Very pleased to have given you some.